true that Professor Crack was looking for a suntan when he went to Guantanamo Bay.
But it is. But I did get one.
And it is not true that he was trying to hop over the fence to play with a Cuban team, and if he had played on that team, they would have won the World Baseball Classic yesterday. But Professor Crack is also a major in the United States Air Force Reserve, but example of what it's like to stand up. I mean, Ibsen called it the enemy of the people. A person was able to stand up and say, this is not right. And Professor Frakt is going to tell you about his experience, the inside of what standing, what right is, what means to our country and to all of us as citizens of the United States.
Thank you, Bob. I'm still on the job at Guantanamo, and I wanted to talk to you tonight a little bit about what it's like to practice at Guantanamo, what physical conditions are like there, give you a little overview of it, and then talk more about my personal experience and my clients and their cases and some of the issues that I've dealt with. So I thought I would start with a little bit of a photo slideshow, since we hear a lot about Guantanamo, but very few people get to actually visit it. This is, coming of an end of an era, perhaps. President Obama has announced the closure of Guantanamo, at least the prison facilities, as a detention camp. When we travel to Guantanamo, this is not a normal job. If I want to meet with my client down there, I have to travel there. And there are no regularly scheduled flights. There's no telephone contact with your client, so you have to go in person. Most of the detainees do not speak English, so usually you go with an interpreter. And we usually would fly down in military cargo planes. And the military has a lot of passenger planes, but they don't give us those. Once you land at Guantanamo, you're not done yet. And we would usually fly out of Andrews Air Force Base or sometimes Baltimore, Washington International Airport, fly down to Guantanamo. They have an airstrip there. And then you have to get on a ferry and cross the bay. And they would drive a truck with our luggage on, and then we get to the other side, unload, and then you carry your bags, and then it's quite a production. Pretty much takes all day just to get down there and get settled. We're brought over to the headquarters of Joint Task Force Guantanamo, not very glamorous, to get your security badge and you have to wear a badge at all times everywhere you go. That's color-coded depending on your security clearance, so what facilities you have access to. They built a whole facility, a whole camp for the military commissions. They built courtrooms, offices, lodging, which you'll see, and sleeping quarters for a whole company of civil engineers who keep the place running. It's a very expensive proposition. They call it Camp Justice, which I think is a misnomer. This shows you a couple of things. First of all, these are shipping containers that have been converted into sleeping trailers, and this is where I would stay normally in one of these. And it's two rooms with a bathroom in the middle. Very Spartan accommodation, just a cot, kind of a bed, and a desk. They gradually, over time, have added a small fridge and a coffee maker. They even have TV. They have cable now and telephones. But when I started going down there, it was very, very Spartan. This larger structure here that you see that looks like a large metal warehouse is the Expeditionary Legal Center, which is what they call the big courtroom that they build down there. And it was designed with the 9/11 co-conspirators in mind. So it is one of the biggest courtrooms you ever see and has six rows of tables for the defense, because they were anticipating originally six 9/11 co-defendants, and then they dropped the charges against one of them. Mohammed al-Qahtani, the alleged 20th hijacker, because he had been tortured. So you can imagine six rows of defense tables. They have an enclosed spectator gallery at the back, and they actually watch through windows, and they can turn the sound off if there's some classified information being discussed. Because it's primarily press and some observers from NGOs, Human Rights Watch, ACLU, Human Rights First, Amnesty International, come down to watch these trials. Very few just random spectators show up because although it is open to the public, it's not a place that the public can get to. So then you have your six rows of defense tables, and then you have, you know, the benches here, jury box would be over here, and prosecution has like two rows of tables. It's an enormous courtroom. This other building, which I have a couple other pictures of, is the headquarters for the military commissions. Here's the headquarters building. My office is over here in the corner. Also, I mean, it's pretty Spartan. We have computers and desks, and that's about it. And they built a courtroom in there that's just a normal size courtroom for the single, you know, one at a time criminal defendants that would be put on trial. So for those of you who were following what I was doing down there, when Ali al-Bulul was tried, he was tried in that building, and all of Muhammad Jawad's proceedings occurred in that building. I did the arraignment of one of my clients, Ali al-Bulul, was in the big building. It was the first time they'd ever used a courtroom, and it was a total disaster. The lights went out, power failure, sound wasn't working, and it was a big embarrassment because it was the first time they had used that courtroom. There's been a lot of glitches of various kinds. There's another picture. You may have seen when detainees were first brought to Guantanamo and they were kept in outdoor cages, essentially, with metal roofs. And those pictures of those early days at Guantanamo have endured for many years, because when they built the new prisons, they never allowed any photographs. So Associated Press and everybody just kept running the picture of the old facility. The detainees were only in these for a few months in the beginning, in the winter of 2002, when they started arriving at Guantanamo. But they were essentially kind of like glorified dog kennels, and they were later moved to more permanent facilities. And you can see they've just let these go to seed, and there's a lot of vegetation growing over. This facility is near the border with Cuba proper, which I'll show you here, what they call Camp X-Ray. So no one has been in here since 2002. People ask what Guantanamo is like. Some people call it Arizona in the Caribbean. It's dry, it's hot. There is a slightly wetter side of the island, where they get some afternoon showers, but it's pretty dry and hot. There are some nice beaches down there, and unfortunately, the detainees, the prisons are right by the ocean, but the detainees, my client told me that he'd only seen the ocean one time in his 6.5 years there. So it's not like they have ocean view. It's another scenic shot. You know, this is a historic naval base. It's been there for a very long time, and so there are some pretty old landmarks there. There are multiple prisons. Two of them were built using blueprints of existing U.S. maximum security prisons. So they're very much like a maximum security or even a supermax facility that you would have here in the U.S. There's also one camp, Camp Delta, that's more like a traditional POW camp with longer sort of cabins that where people, like a Hogan's Heroes or type thing, where people sleep communally and they can go out during the day and exercise. And that's the goal for all the detainees, is to get into that camp where the conditions are better. But they make it very, very hard to meet the criteria to get in there. This is me at the border crossing to Cuba, and once a month the base commander from the Guantanamo Naval Base and a representative of the Cuban government will meet here, and they have a little conference room. There's one on the American side, one on the Cuban side, and they alternate each month, and they discuss issues. And so they do actually get some people who are fence hoppers and come and seek political asylum occasionally, about three per month. There's a vulture. There's a lot of vultures on Guantanamo. Also a lot of iguanas. They're famous for their iguanas. This one's about 3 feet long. I've seen them up to 4 feet long. There's a kind of a joke at Guantanamo is they're protected species, and the joke is that the iguanas are treated better than the detainees. They, after each hearing that we would hold down there, we would have a press conference typically, and for a while we were just doing it in a kind of a aircraft hangar. This is me after I had a 14-hour long marathon hearing on June 19th, 2008. Some of you may have read the closing argument I gave about the torture of my client, and this is right after that. And here's a picture. I was completely wiped out. This is how exhausted I was. They later built a better-looking press room that, you know, looks more professional. We had some fun times, you know, even though it's very stressful work and high pressure. But on the day of the Hamdan trial, we had a little office pool on what Hamdan, that was, you know, Osama bin Laden's chauffeur that they put on trial, what sentence he was going to get. And most people thought he was going to get really hammered. But I thought he was only going to get 5 months, so that's my prediction. And turned out that I was right, because that's exactly what he got. So I won the office pool and was happy. Here's me gloating a little bit. Actually, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in Washington, D.C., there is a military commission's appeals court called the Court of Military Commission Review, but they don't actually have a building. They don't have a facility. It's just, so they, because they've only held really two oral arguments, and this was one of them, and I did it, and Professor Brennan came and watched, so it was nice to have him there. And it was the argument was about whether the government could use statements that had been obtained through torture, were the product of torture. And what does it mean for a statement to be the product of torture? The government was arguing that a statement can only be the product of torture if a person is actively being tortured by the interrogator. So if they're on the rack and they say, I did it, that's a statement produced by torture. But if the interrogator lets them off the rack, comes back 10 minutes later and says, so tell me, did you do it? And he says, yeah, I did it. They said, that's not the product of torture. That's not what the law has ever been. The common law of torture and international law of torture is that once you've been tortured, there's a kind of a presumption that the effects of that torture will linger, that you will continue to confess out of fear that you'll be tortured again and so forth. So unless the interrogators do something specifically to break the chain of events and distance themselves, reassure the person they're not going to be harmed, that the confession would still be deemed to be the product of the earlier torture. I know some of you may have read Mark Danner's piece in the New York Times and New York Review of Books recently about torture that was used on high-value detainees, so-called high-value detainees, at the secret CIA ghost prisons. And so at those facilities, they were using waterboarding to a limited extent. They were actually slamming people against the wall. They had created a sort of a plastic collar that I guess would prevent them from being killed, but they would nevertheless slam them against the wall. They were putting people in very small boxes, depriving them of of light, extremes of heat, extremes of cold, being naked for extended periods in very cold conditions, having cold water poured over you, being deprived of solid food for extended periods, being sleep deprived, being forced to stand with your hands chained to something overhead or to the wall in a very uncomfortable position, where, you know, if you fell asleep, you would, all your weight would be on your wrists. So it's hard to imagine Americans doing these things, but this did happen, and it was at the direct orders of the administration at the highest levels. Now, my client, Mohammed Jawad, the teenager, was captured on December 17th, 2002, in Kabul, Afghanistan, and he was taken the next morning to Bagram prison, where he was beaten up, you know, kicked, punched. He had a hood placed over his head. The hooding was a very frightening experience for the detainees because they didn't know where the next hit was coming from or what was going to happen. And he was said he was repeatedly pushed down the stairs while his hands and feet were shackled, so you have no way of breaking your fall. But the psychological torture in many ways was worse. It was the threat of being killed or having your family killed, of never seeing your family again, of being locked up forever. Another common technique was the sleep deprivation, and that was done in a couple different ways. One would be simply just playing loud music constantly, kind of a form of torture in itself. Some detainees reported them playing like rap soundtracks like 24 hours a day, very loud, sometimes just the same song over and over again. So that makes it very hard to sleep. There would be bright lights that would be on in the cell at all times, also making it very difficult to sleep. The guards would be walking by, you know, every couple of minutes, banging on the prison, the bars, or the metal doors. And then they actually had a systematized method of sleep deprivation called the frequent flyer program, where to ensure that people wouldn't be able to sleep, they move them every couple of hours from cell to cell. And a movement of a detainee requires that their hands and feet be shackled. It's quite an elaborate procedure, and then they move them down the hall into another cell, and so then you have to unshackle, and it's time consuming and very disruptive. For my client Mohammed Jawad, in May 2004, he was subjected to a 14-day sleep deprivation regime, the frequent flyer program, in which he was moved 112 times. In this 14-day period. So on average of every 3 hours, including an extra move that they threw in between 12 and 3 at night. So, you know, it was particularly disruptive. And he described this as being, you know, very disturbing and disorienting period that he just thought it was never going to end. And when he first described it to me, I just thought, it was crazy, you know, that something like that could not have happened. But then later, the prosecutor, who was a very decent guy and later ended up resigning out of principle, Lieutenant Colonel Daryl Vandeveld, sent me the prison records, which detailed, and they detailed everything, that showed all 112 moves, you know, the time, the cell. So when I say that, that's from the government's own records, and that's been proven in court and acknowledged. Other people were subjected to sleep deprivation for much longer periods, 30, 60 days. And there was a number of investigations into treatment of detainees, particularly after Abu Ghraib. And the upshot of those reports was that there had been some minor abuse, but it was all in the past, and everything was fine now. But I discovered through my internal investigations and through the discovery process that the sleep deprivation, the frequent flyer, continued until at least April 2005. So I think that I do not believe they are currently torturing people at Guantanamo, and I don't think they have for the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, there is an occasional dust-up between, you know, a detainee and the guards where the guards use excessive force. That happened with my client just last June, where they got in a dispute over some religious items in my client's cell that he thought were being mishandled by the guards, and they said he was resisting. So he, although his hands and feet were shackled, and there's a chain running between them, he was thrown on the floor. Two guards jumped on him. They started pummeling him, and they pepper sprayed him in the eyes because they said he was resisting. So it's just, you know, hard to imagine how he could have been resisting. And you got to understand, this guy is like very, very skinny, wiry, so would not be a threat to a couple of burly guards. But so there were orders from Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld approving a number of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques in, I think, early 2003. And although that approval was later revoked, there was just a lot of these things continued anyway. And some creative people took it upon themselves to come up with innovative manners of treating the detainees. So when people, when the President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and others said repeatedly over and over again and continue to say, we don't torture, we didn't torture, they're just lying. They are absolutely lying. They know they're lying. You know, they may be basing that statement on their own interpretation of what torture is, which has been rejected by everybody else, but they absolutely know. And one of the senior Bush administration officials, Susan Crawford, who was the head of the military commissions, acknowledged that at least that one person, Al-Qahtani, had been tortured, and she used the word torture, and she was the first Bush official to acknowledge that. You know, most people think that there's no question that waterboarding is torture, but putting people in a box, physically beating them, you know, clearly that's torture as well. And the sleep deprivation has been acknowledged in a couple of international bodies as being a form of psychological torture. In my case, the judge found that it was done for the specific purpose of seriously disrupting the personality, which is a definition of torture, and found, he said, well, I don't need to decide if it's torture, but I do find that it's cruel, abusive, and inhumane. So don't be fooled. Now, that doesn't mean that these are all good people and therefore we should all let them go, but we have severely hampered our own ability to prosecute some of these people that deserve to be prosecuted by treating them, you know, in this way. And also, I want to emphasize that there's a big lie that torture yielded positive intelligence that saved lives. There has been absolutely no evidence whatsoever of that. And all the people who are experienced in interrogations will tell you, and this, I've talked to a lot of interrogators, that all you get is unreliable information. What works is rapport building over time, treating people decently, and eventually they'll tell you, you know, everything you want to know. So it was a 24 mentality, but there was no ticking time bomb. Very good question. Why did they mistreat Mohammed Jawad? And this was, by the way, he had attempted to commit suicide. He was so miserable. And about 3 months later, that's when they did this frequent flyer treatment on him. The use of sleep deprivation was an approved interrogation technique, but it was supposed to be limited to 4 days, and it was supposed to be approved at the highest levels. Well, What I found in reviewing his interrogation records was that he had not been interrogated during the frequent flyer program or for almost 5 months after. So it was not for intelligence gathering purposes at all. I later was able to find the person who was sort of administering the frequent flyer program, and he said that it was standard operating procedure and that dozens of people were subjected to it. And he said it was an incentive program, part of their program of incentives and disincentives, I guess, to behave well. And he said, well, we only use this on the worst people, the feces throwers and things like that. There was no evidence that my client ever did anything like that. His worst offense that I was able to find was something called cross-block talking, where when he was linguistically isolated and there was no one he could talk to, he would shout across the other people who spoke his language. So to answer your question, the mistreatment of detainees at one point had become sort of institutionalized and was not strictly limited to intelligence gathering. Well, great question, because there's so much misinformation being distributed by those who have an interest in keeping Guantanamo open or in defending the policies of the past. There were upwards of 800 detainees at Guantanamo at one time. There are 240 there now. So we have over 560 who have been released. The Defense Department has cited a number of some 30 to 40 individuals that supposedly engaged in some form of terrorist activity upon release, but they've only identified three or four who actually did some kind of violence, like one guy was a suicide bomber and, you know, that kind of thing. There's a study by Mark Denbow, a professor at Seton Hall, who has tried to evaluate these claims because so little information is actually provided. And what he was able to determine is that many of the people that they claim to have rejoined the battlefield become enemies again, they were, the people who were making that determination were doing it very broadly and encompassed such activities as writing editorials that were critical of the United States detention policies. That was seen as rejoining the fight. So I think it's a very small percentage. And I also think that, to answer the other part of your question, what percentage are really dangerous? Nobody really knows. Of the 241 that are there, 60 have been cleared for release. That is, they've been determined, even by the Bush administration, that they are not enemy combatants. But they were not released because they didn't want to go back to their home country, or we were reluctant to send them, particularly like China, for example, the Chinese Uyghurs. It's a Muslim minority that's oppressed in China. So we said, well, we're not going to send them back to China. But none of the other countries wanted to take them. So there's a large diplomatic effort underway to find a place for these 60 detainees who've already been determined to be innocent, and just we have no basis for lawful basis for detaining them. And basically, our European allies are saying, well, we'll take a couple. If you take a couple, you let a few of those people, you know, you're telling us they're not dangerous, that it was a mistake was made, but you know, how do we sell this to our citizens if that we should take some, you know, this is your problem, how do we sell this if you're not willing to take a few? So I think that's what's going to happen, is that a small handful will be resettled in the U.S., possibly of these Chinese Uyghurs, and there's a number of families of Uyghur descent who said we'd be happy to sponsor them, and Canada may take a few, and a few will be resettled. Then you have the other 180. Now, at its peak, the chief prosecutor said that they were planning to charge some 75 detainees with crimes, with war crimes. So that means at most you have 75 of those 180 that they thought committed some kind of terrorist act or war crime. And when I talk to the chief prosecutor who quit, Colonel Morris Davis, he said realistically we only had maybe 35 to 40 that we thought we could make a case on. But so that means of the 180, you know, there's over 100 that they don't think they have enough to charge him with. And I have to tell you that in federal court, the crime of material support to terrorism is something very easy to prove. If you can prove that someone even, you know, joined or tried to join al-Qaeda, you know, they're going to get 20 years. So I think it's a very small handful. It's just my personal opinion. Oh, by the way, my views do not represent the views of the United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, President Obama, or anybody else. So I think it's a small number. I don't think we really know. What I can tell you is that everything that came out of the previous administration was grossly exaggerated. And when they they fought for years to prevent the detainees from having the right to challenge their detention in court. And we had this long litigation that ultimately resulted in the detainees twice being reaffirmed that they have the right to habeas corpus. And so finally we get some of these cases into the federal district court in Washington. And there have been 27 where have gone to trial and the government had to put on their proof that this person was an enemy combatant. And the U.S. federal district judges, both Republican appointees, have said on 23 of the 27, the government has not met the preponderance of the evidence standard to hold these people. So that tells me that you just can't trust in the numbers that you've been given. And when I was invited to meet with President Obama's transition team in the Department of Defense. Jay Johnson, who's now the DOD General Counsel, was leading the transition team, reviewing the legal issues. And, you know, and my advice to him was, you have to take a fresh look at all these. You can't assume that any of this is true. There may very well be dangerous people. We have a mixture of hardcore al-Qaeda terrorists, foot soldiers, people who were in the wrong place at the wrong time, people who are turned over for bounty. You've got to sort through it. So that is what they are doing right now. That each file, and President Obama, his second day in office, issued this executive order which said, I want every branch of government, all the intelligence agents, everything, turn over everything you have on these detainees in one central place, and we're going to go through it, and we're going to figure out if we have a lawful basis to hold these people. And he gave them until May 20th to do it. So it's 4 months. It's kind of, you know, if you're in Guantanamo and you're a detainee, that seems like a long time, but that's pretty fast if we consider how long things have taken in the past. So I think what's going to happen on May 20th, or before that, we will see a fairly large number of people released, a number of people transferred to federal custody to be tried in federal court. And then there's this theoretical third category of people who are too dangerous to release but can't be tried. Now, I don't know who is in that category. They've never identified anyone who's in that category or why. How do we know that they are so dangerous that they can't be released, but yet they didn't commit any crime that they could be prosecuted for? I mean, what makes us so sure that they're so dangerous if they've never done anything? And that is a big mystery, and we really wonder who that alleged third category is and whether it really exists. So that will be interesting to see. Yes. Well, I am on active duty military, so I'm paid by you, the taxpayer, and each... Under the rules of the Military Commissions Act, each detainee is appointed a military defense counsel, whether they want one or not. And in my case, one of my clients really didn't want me, and he was al-Qaeda. And he was very proud of it, and he stood up in the courtroom every time he had a chance and said, I'm al-Qaeda. I pledge my allegiance and undying loyalty to Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, death to America, death to the Jews, etc. And by the way, I don't want you as my lawyer. But I was paid good money for sitting there as a potted plant and not defending it. There are also there's very few military defense counsel who have death penalty experience. For a long time in the military, we didn't have the death penalty. We don't have a lot of murders in the military. It's pretty rare. But most of the detainees that are being charged in military commissions are facing the death penalty. So the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and the ACLU put together funding something called the John Adams Project, and I think George Soros was a contributor. They got a defense fund together to provide well-qualified civilian lawyers who were death penalty qualified to assist the military council. And so the military council would be lead counsel, would assemble a team of well-qualified people, and there was funding for them. However, for other types of funding, we would have to ask the so-called convening authority, that Susan Crawford, who's a political appointee. If I want an expert consultant, expert witness, anything like that, I had to go to her and ask and try to justify the expense, and more often than not, she would just say no, whether I had a good justification or not. So funding has been a problem, and this extra defense fund for the civilian council is only for the death penalty cases and not for my teenager, Muhammad Jawad, who's only facing life in prison. Yes.
Does the term enemy combatant have any meaning in international law?
Yeah, I think it does. I'm not sure that unlawful enemy combatant does, but there is a concept of people who have engaged in combat and can be removed from the battlefield and detained during a conflict. But it's kind of, that particular nomenclature is something that the U.S. Kind of invented. There is a concept under international law of an unprivileged belligerent. And what the Bush administration did was conflate two different concepts: unprivileged belligerency and war criminal. There is something called a combatant immunity under the law of war. That is, if you are a soldier or, a member of the uniformed military and you are fighting a war, you have immunity for your hostile acts. If you kill people, destroy things, you can't be prosecuted for that so long as you comply with the laws of war. If, on the other hand, you violate the laws of war, for example, Lieutenant Calley in Vietnam, and you kill innocent women and children, you can be prosecuted, even though you are a lawful combatant and you are entitled to combatant immunity. Someone who lacks combatant immunity would be called an unprivileged belligerent or an unlawful combatant. They're not entitled under international law to fight. And in order to be a lawful combatant, you have to be in uniform and carry your arms openly and things like that, and comply with the laws of war. So what the Bush administration's position was is that there was no one, there was not a single person in Afghanistan who was allowed to fight the United States. We can invade that country, we're lawful combatants, anyone fights back, they're unlawful combatants. That was a position that was difficult to really sustain. But they also decided that not only are they not allowed to fight, but the mere act of fighting is a war crime. And that's something that was not supported in international law. So they conflated these two concepts. And the other thing is that they didn't do is that there is supposed to be a presumption that when someone is picked up on the battlefield that they are entitled to be treated as a prisoner of war. And if there's doubt about that, they're entitled to a hearing, something called Article 5 tribunal under the Geneva Conventions. That was never done. That step was simply skipped. President Bush said, none of these people are entitled to POW status. I'm making a blanket determination. And that there was no basis for that in international law. Yes? I think one of the primary challenges is building a trusting relationship with your client. This has proved to be a huge hurdle that very few lawyers were able to overcome. The habeas counsel, the civilian habeas counsel, have been more successful in this than the military counsel. You can imagine, I want to read you something. This is from the arraignment of my client Muhammad Jawad on March 12, 2008. Now, he had a different lawyer at that time, and this was his first court appearance, and he had been in Guantanamo for just over 5 years at that point. never charged, and then finally he's charged with something. And so the first order of business in the arraignment is for the judge to advise him of his right to counsel and ask him what he wants. The judge says, "Do you wish to be represented by your appointed counsel who is seated at your table?" Muhammad says, "I don't want this counsel. I don't want this session, and I don't want any trial in court. I'm asking a question. Are you treating me with justice and fairness, or are you not treating me with justice and fairness?" So the judge attempts to reassure Mr. Jawad that he was trying to treat him with justice and fairness. He says, "Now, my question for you is, do you desire to be represented by your appointed counsel?" "Not only him, but nobody can represent me. It's against the law. You know it's against the law. It's unlawful, and I don't want the representation." The judge: "So I understand you do not want to be represented by your appointed counsel. Is that correct?" "Not only him. Even if someone else was appointed, I wouldn't want them. I'm upset, and I want justice and fairness." The judge: "So I understand you don't want to be represented by your appointed counsel. And do I also understand correctly that you don't want some other military attorney appointed to represent you? Is that correct?" "I don't want this decision at all. I want justice, and I want it now. I don't want any attorney. I'm innocent. I've been treated unfairly. Since I've been arrested, I've been treated unfairly. I've been tortured. I'm a human being. I've not violated any law. I have not infringed anybody's rights. Whatever has been done to me is illegal. I've been brought here illegally." "Well, how'd you like to be the next lawyer?" Because that next lawyer was me. This lawyer was excused. He was another reservist. He was on a one-year tour and was returned to civilian life, and I was appointed to take over. As I said, they don't actually get a choice. They are stuck with, they have to have a military lawyer. Now, theoretically, they're entitled to represent themselves, and that's what my other client decided he wanted to do, but the one judge said he could, and then another judge later rescinded that. How do you build a trusting relationship with someone who's just enraged, who sees the military as their enemy, who has been tortured by military? When I went in to see him the first time, he's like, how do I know you're a lawyer? How do I know that you are what you say you are? You could be anybody. I mean, lots of people have promised me lots of things. Lots of people have told me lots of things. I said, "You don't know that." He said, "How do I know I should trust you?" I said, "You don't. Don't." I said, "Don't trust me. I don't want you to trust me. I don't want you to trust anyone. What I want you to do, what I'd like you to do, is to go with me one time into the courtroom and watch what I do. And then decide. And we'll take it one step at a time. And you can fire me at any time. I work for you. I don't work for the U.S. military. They're just paying my bill. Okay? I work for you. You're the boss. If you're not satisfied at any time, just say the word, and I'm out of here." And so that, and it came to, they were re-arraigning him. I left here right after my last class. I drove to Washington. I was appointed to represent him on May 29th, or April 29th. April 30th, I flew to Guantanamo. I met him for the first time May 1st, and his arraignment was May 7th. So I didn't have a lot of time to build this rapport. But what I suggested to him, I said, the judge is going to ask you if you want me to represent you. But you don't have to commit. My proposal was, why don't you let me represent you for the limited purpose of challenging your conditions of confinement and challenging the legitimacy of the military commissions? Let's not even talk about trial. I agree. I told him, I agree with you. It is unfair. It is illegitimate. You have been mistreated. That's why I'm here. You know, I left a cushy law professor job in Southern California to come here to do this for you because I believe, I had to tell him I believed he was innocent. I didn't really believe that at the time. But I later did come to believe it. But I told him, I believe you're innocent, and I believe you mistreated, and I believe this system is rigged, and I'm going to fight. So he agreed to that, and we were able to build a relationship over time. The logistics are very hard. As I mentioned, you have to fly down there. It's usually on one of these, C-130. You know, it takes 3 days to go down and back, and you know, for a short visit. many of the detainees have been, you know, as they've been tortured and it's caused mental health problems. Even if they haven't been tortured, they've just been locked up in this kind of solitary confinement for so long that it's driving them crazy. So they have paranoia issues. They think they're being bugged because there's a camera in every room. They don't trust talking to you. So it takes a while to build that up, and they don't give you a lot of time. The discovery and whether you get the evidence that you're entitled to, unfortunately, is a matter of whether you luck into getting the right prosecutor and the right judge. The rules are designed so that if they want to withhold the evidence from you, they can, and you're not going to know. How do you know that they're withholding someone when you don't know what they have? You know, it becomes very hard. You suspect that they may have something. The rules, sometimes if they don't want you to have something, they'll just classify it, or they'll just say, like there was a report on detainee mistreatment that had some very relevant information about the frequent flyer program. They let me see the report, but they wouldn't let me have the report. And of course, even if they did let me have it, I couldn't show it to my client because he's not entitled to see classified information. So those kind of things make it very difficult. Right. Well, what happened, it's December 17, 2002. It's in Kabul. And someone threw a hand grenade through the back window of an American Jeep and exploded in the Jeep. Two U.S. soldiers were injured. They both had flak vests on, so that caught most of the shrapnel. And so they had some shrapnel injuries, but they were okay. One is now returned to a civilian job as a Long Beach police officer. The other is on active duty. So, you know, nobody died here, but they didn't see who threw the hand grenade. Now, this happened in the broad daylight in a crowded public bazaar. So, and the police were on the scene very quickly, and they arrested several people. Reports vary from 3 to 5 people. The Americans, soldiers, the unit that these soldiers came from, went to the Afghan police station and demanded that the person responsible for this be turned over. And Mohammad Jawad was one of the people arrested. They, after several hours of interrogating Mohammad Jawad, during which they threatened to kill him if he didn't confess, they produced a written confession. Now, Mohammad Jawad doesn't read and he doesn't write. The confession was written in a language that he doesn't even speak. And they told the Americans, "We've got your culprit, and we're going to turn him over. He's the one solely responsible for this." They didn't tell them about all the other people that they arrested that were adults. And those people, I think, were the ones that were primarily responsible for this attack. Mohammad Jawad was just a kid. I don't know if he threw the hand grenade or not. There's evidence that he was drugged, that he was by these people. But what I do know is that he didn't get to Kabul on his own. Somebody brought him there. And the people that were captured, the other people that were captured, have disappeared. Did they pay a bribe to get out? Did the Afghans kill them because they thought they were real terrorists? We don't know what happened to them. So there's a lot of unanswered questions, and it's impossible to investigate. You have someone who threw a hand grenade in a crowded public bazaar. Somebody saw that. In fact, the civilians on the scene were the ones that tackled the culprits or the suspects. None of those people were ever interviewed. Nobody got their names, contact information. So it's trying to reconstruct what happened now 6.5 years later. It's impossible. But the crime that they charged him with is something called attempted murder in violation of the law of war. Well, if he threw the hand grenade, which again, they can't really prove. The only evidence they have are his two tortured confessions that the judge has now thrown out and said these were the product of torture. But even if they could prove that he threw it, well, that could be attempted murder. right? You throw in a grenade at somebody, you're probably trying to kill them. But it's not in violation of the law of war. During a war, during an armed conflict, you are allowed to try to kill the enemy in uniform. You know, uniformed enemy soldiers in a military jeep are lawful targets. So it's not. And this is where I come back to this idea of conflating unlawful combatants with war criminals. They're saying, well, because he wasn't in uniform, that makes ordinary common law attempted murder into a war crime. Now, if he had done it and they had investigated, the Afghan police could have brought him to the Afghan juvenile criminal justice system and tried him. But there was no lawful basis to bring him to the U.S. We have no extradition treaty with Afghanistan. Under their constitution that we helped write, it's illegal to remove anyone from Afghanistan for the purpose of trying him. So that's why I say, you know, I think he may be innocent. And there's really almost no evidence to substantiate the charges. And I was pretty sure that I was going to get an acquittal if we ever got to trial. They had this idea that somehow we were facing a new threat that was different and greater than anything we'd ever faced before, and that called for new measures. And that, I think, was one of the great mistakes. This isn't a new threat. It's not any bigger or any different. Yes, they had one spectacularly successful attack on 9/11. But they had... That doesn't make it something of unprecedented magnitude that requires us to throw the Constitution out the window. They created a war of ideals, and we played directly into their hands. Instead of saying we're comfortable with what we stand for and we're not going to sink to your level, we did start to sink to their level. So it's hard for me to say, you know, take the other side. What, you know, on the network news, on the radio and everything these days, if there's one position presented, you know, they'll say that's the liberal position, and then they'll bring some conservative to take the other position. But I think there are some things that are just absolute, that there doesn't need to be another side. There's no one in the world who should be in favor of torture. We have all signed a treaty that says torture is prohibited under all circumstances. So why don't we just follow that? I don't know if that answers your question, but it's hard for me to... I can understand the pressure that people were under at the time. They did think that there might be another attack coming. And they thought that, you know, if that happened on their watch and more Americans were killed, you know, that would be this catastrophic failure, and that was their sacred duty to protect Americans. But I think in their zeal to defend America from the next terrorist attack, they forgot about the oath that they took. And the oath is to defend the Constitution of the United States. And for better or for worse, because the Constitution doesn't permit the government to do everything within its power to stop crime, to stop terrorism. It allows people some freedom of movement, and sometimes there are bad actors out there. But we have to preserve and protect the Constitution and the American way of life. Helios.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the Constitution law.
Lieutenant Colonel Darrell Vandeveld, I think he's a real hero in this. You know, when he started, and he volunteered, and he was a career prosecutor, he's an Army reservist, but he had spent several years in Iraq and Afghanistan and Djibouti and the Horn of Africa. And, you know, he wanted to prosecute the terrorists that were responsible for 9/11. And a lot of people were motivated to join the prosecution by that opportunity. And certainly those people deserve to be prosecuted and put away for a long time, and maybe even the death penalty. I'm not a big supporter of it in general, but, you know, if anybody ever deserved it, they do, okay? But so he gets handed this case, and at first it seems pretty straightforward. It seems pretty clear cut. Okay, we've got a guy who confessed in writing, sworn, We have another confession that's videotaped. We have, allegedly, we have eyewitnesses who will swear that it happened. Case closed, slam dunk. But as we started getting into the evidence and you know, looking over it more closely, he came to see all these holes and gaps that I'm talking about and realized that there was corrupt Afghan police that really couldn't be trusted. The video tape confession disappeared and we never surfaced again. The written confession turned out to be, you know, not in the guy's language. Like, he couldn't read it. What they told him is, this is your release paperwork. Put your thumbprint here. He couldn't even sign his name. What was the question again? I'm sorry. Oh, the prosecutor. Why did... So he also was appalled at the treatment of Mohammed Jawad, a teenager. We have signed a treaty. It's called the Optional Protocol on the Involvement of Children in Armed Conflict. And it requires that if we capture a juvenile in a battle situation, that they be provided... that they can be held accountable, okay? They can be prosecuted, but it has to be in a system that is designed for their ultimate rehabilitation and reintegration into society. There's a recognition that children are not well equipped to comply with the laws of war and probably are there because of some adult influences. And the military commissions took no note of that. There's no provision for juveniles. There's no provision for children. Guantanamo... They drew a arbitrary line at 14, and the people that they thought were 14 or under, they treated as kids. But 15, 16, or 17, you were treated as an adult, put in with an adult population. So if that's not bad enough, then they tortured him. And we had evidence that he was from his mistreatment at Bagram, his mistreatment at Guantanamo. So he came to think, and then we had this crime that he was charged with that... one expert after another said, this is not a war crime. And so he did not feel that he had a good faith basis as a prosecutor to continue prosecuting this case. Furthermore, even if he did, he did not believe, particularly after the Hamden sentence of 5 months, that this guy was going to get any more than time served, you know, with all the mitigation and nobody died. And, you know, I mean, so it's like, why are we putting this enormous resources into prosecuting this kid that we're not going to get any benefit? I mean, aren't the military commissions supposed to be about real terrorists? And he just decided, and then he kept finding more evidence that was kind of being hidden, and there were other intelligence agencies that weren't turning things over and were thwarting his ethical obligation to turn over exculpatory evidence, and he just felt like it was not a viable legal system.
They're hiding evidence from the prosecutor.
Pardon?
They're hiding evidence from the prosecutor?
Yes, they are. And then some prosecutors are hiding it from us, so it's a lot of hiding going on. Okay. Well, that's a little bit about what I've been doing at Guantanamo. I mean, it would take me several hours to tell you everything, and I wanted to take your questions rather than just tell you things that you weren't. Thank you.